Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And as we always do, as we follow up New Year's, and sometimes it's not on the 2nd, but fortunately, it is the 2nd, because the 2nd of January is the day that the big Tory Acts came out. Now, we're not starting off with the Tory Acts. We're going to be starting off with the Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights, and so kind of talked about what the plan was as of yesterday. So what we're going to do is welcome Sean back, and we don't have Tammy today. So, unfortunately, we will just bear the load without her while she's probably hitting the slopes. Anyway, welcome back.
Good to be here, sir.
Awesome. So, folks, as we lay this out, the reason why we start this curriculum and we cover everything the way we do is to really help you understand how well our framers were educated, and I'll even say they were indoctrinated into being very, I'll just say very jealous of their rights. They demanded to be treated like Englishmen. They may have been in colonies, but they were English colonies, and they all came from England. It's not like they were indigenous or anything separate from them. So they felt entitled to the rights of an Englishman. And so that's some of the things that they were taught. Unfortunately, as citizens of England, they were taught that. But unfortunately, as citizens of the United States, we're not taught our history, our rights, and how to guard them. This has been one of the biggest, I don't want to call it tragedies. The reality is this was a part of the plan. This was a part of the way they were going to take away our birthright from us. You don't teach people what they need to know and how to defend themselves when they see their rights starting to erode. Then, voila, they succeed because they've convinced us that the process is to, you know, amass out in the streets and start screaming and so forth and protesting and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, it's all about Constitution compliance, holding everybody accountable. And I'm telling you right now, nobody wants to be held accountable. Nobody. And that is probably the biggest problem. So anyway, in the Magna Carta, and I think most everybody knows the story, but for those people who don't, it was getting bad in England under the hand of King John. But the interesting thing was King John wasn't really that bad of a despot, not like Bloody Mary and or some of the other, I'll say, you know, because actually I believe Bloody Mary was a daughter from King John's line. But anyway, things were getting bad, and it got to the point where 25 land barons ended up concocting a plan where they were going to get the king alone and draw swords upon him, isolate him and get him alone and draw swords upon him so that he had no guards and that they would be able to threaten his life so that they could ensure or some way work out a way that they could have the rights for themselves and for their subjects. See, the land barons, in those days, most of the people of Britain were kind of like serfs. In other words, there were people that were kind of a part of that land, a part of those counties that they hadn't even established the counties at that point in time. So the people that were living and working the land, they were the minions, they were the masses. And so anyway, the land barons basically created a system to protect their rights as well as their serfs' rights, or those people who were British living you know, and working in their land areas. These land barons ended up becoming, or I should say, King John and the monarchs of Britain concocted a plan to elevate their stature to where their line and these men or their offspring, as time went on, was granted this title of nobility. In other words, they became counts. And as they became counts, as they ruled their area, they considered, instead of calling it land baron area, they called it a county under the rule of the count. And the counts became a nobility and or a royalty, a class of royalty in England, to where ultimately they didn't want to soil their hands in land, managing the minions and so forth. And this is how things went awry again. I mean, it took a long time to get so far to where they actually had a revolt, and that's where I think it was the 1680s revolt against Cromwell and against the Puritan policies. We just covered this for the Christmas show. But bottom line, England, the people of Britain, they understood what they needed to do. And it wasn't like they were capable of quickly revolting, and they had problems under Queen Mary. I mean, it was so despotic and so forth. They had some pretty dark times in Britain. But at this point in time, for the first time in the history of mankind, rights for the people were actually written down and guaranteed that the people of Britain were guaranteed these very specific rights. One of the most important rights that they were granted was the right of assembling and petitioning. So therefore, that's what we're going to kind of cover today, is the laying out of these rights before we get to the Tory Acts. So if you're ready, Sean, if you download the Magna Carta 1215, the Avalon document, that we'll have up on the website, and I think it's up there on the academic source page already. If you download this, there's only one paragraph that we're going to be worried about. Some people call it chapter, but it's really not chapter, and or section, what have you. These are paragraphs. And so it's paragraph 61, where they actually go through and negotiate the terms of the right of petition. And so it's not easy to read because it's really old English, you know, vernacular. Now, it's colored in yellow with red text, and then red with yellow text, and then there's red with black text. The black text is kind of covering in other words. And so sometimes when people read the in other words parts, it doesn't lend well because of the cumbersome vernacular that they're using, because they introduce you to a justicar and or these other things, and these are kind of speaking to and more of roles and or titles of people. But anyway, the important part here is what we're going to focus on. We're going to read this whole thing because it's just about a page and a half, or maybe just a little over a page. We'll read this whole thing, but the stuff that really comes out where the right of petition and the teeth of the right of petition is right there in the red. So anyway, Sean, let's go ahead and read that first yellow section with the red text. Go ahead. Thanks.
Since, moreover, for God and the amendment of our kingdom and for the better allaying of the quarrel that has arisen between us and our barons, we have granted all these concessions, desirous that they should enjoy them in complete and firm endurance forever. We give and grant to them the underwritten security, namely, that the barons choose 25 barons of the kingdom, whomsoever they will, who shall be bound with all their might to observe and hold, and cause to be observed, the peace and liberties we have granted and confirmed to them by this our present charter.
Okay, so this is called a charter because the king, being the sovereign, is granting this. So it's not like a contract. A charter is where a king makes a promise that he's, you know, in other words, it's a contract of the king, you know, giving certain things and promising certain things. The difference between a contract is when two people agree what that is. But in this particular case, everything had to come to the point where the king would agree. So there wasn't, I don't want to say there wasn't negotiations, because, you know, those 25 swords were a pretty compelling argument. But when we look and review, you know, the way the language is, this is really the king granting these things. And so now he is going to provide what the process of redress is if there's a problem. Now, again, there's the bailiffs and justicars. These are basically the officers of the king's court. Because remember, we kind of covered this, maybe brushed over this, but as Britain evolved from the civil law when they were captured and ruled by the Roman Empire, they ended up adopting the laws of the Anglo-Saxon system, and then they migrated over to common law. They didn't want to go by civil law, because civil law was basically the law of man, where statues and men created the law. They wanted, with common law, this concept of common law was to basically rule the law, or the law would be ruled by the Bible or God. Now, keep in mind, in 1215, nobody had the Bible. So they were dependent on those, you know, members or the leadership of the church at that point in time to, yeah, this is copacetic with God. And so they were already under a common law system, kind of creating this case precedence type of thing, that this is acceptable, you know, with the word of God, this isn't, so forth. But they still didn't have a Bible. The Bibles weren't printed and put into the hands of the people until the 16th century. I mean, you know, 300 years down the road. So at this point, what they're doing, though, is they're actually creating the rights of the people, like I said before. So now he gets into the process of getting how the people could get redress for their grievances. So go ahead. And you're probably muted.
So that if we or our justiciar or our bailiffs or any one of our officers shall anything be at fault towards anyone, or shall have broken any one of the articles of this peace or of this security, and the offense be notified to four barons of the foresaid 25, the said barons shall repair to us, or our justiciar, if we are out of the realm, and laying the transgression before us, petition to have that transgression redressed without delay. And if we shall not have corrected the transgression, or in the event of our being out of the realm, if our justiciar shall not have corrected it within 40 days, reckoning from the time it has been intimated to us, or to our justiciar, if we shall be out of the realm, the four barons aforesaid shall refer that matter to the rest of the 25 barons, and those 25 barons shall together with the community of the whole realm distrain and distress us in all possible ways, namely by seizing our castles, lands, possessions, and in any other way they can, until redress has been obtained as they deem fit, saving harmless our own person and the persons of our queen and children. And when redress has been obtained, they shall resume their old relations toward us.
Okay, so keep in mind, in this time, the paradigm of the monarch was that the monarchs were chosen by God. In other words, when we kind of look at the king, he was anointed by the Pope, or by whoever the Pope had been identifying, you know, go coronate this king to lead the good people of Britain. And so under this point in time, it was the Roman Catholic Empire that was ruling Europe. So the Pope was basically setting up cardinals or what have you to go do the coronation, because the Pope didn't travel that much. Traveling back in those days was so austere that, you could die. And it was a lot of strain. It's not like, most people complain about the rigors of travel by just having to drive to the airport, getting onto an aircraft with a whole bunch of other people with your luggage, and then flying somewhere in a cramped space, and then, unpacking, and then, all of that stress, people, I just hate to travel. Some people like it, but most people, they don't like it. Well, in retrospect, or in light of the difference between what it took, for the Pope to travel up to Britain, it would probably take a year to get up there and back. There was no really quick way of travel. Actually, I take that back. It probably wasn't a year, but nonetheless, it took months at least, no doubt, to get onto a ship and float up to the Isle of Britain and float back. Going over land, that would have been a lot longer and a lot more arduous. You had to deal with weather and so forth. So, folks, understanding what it would take for that coronation, but the point of going into why these kings were coronated and why the tone was, because if you read this, if you actually understood what Sean just read, Sean said that if somebody comes and actually identifies a transgression by using a petition for redress, that if the redress has not been granted within 40 days, and this is a legitimate petition, in other words, yes, dead to right, you have a right to these things, and so if we don't fix these, the cost or the teeth in not fixing things is, as it says, the entire realm is theirs, namely by seizing our castles, lands, and possessions. So in other words, the people had a right to take everything from the king, but they couldn't take his monarchy. In other words, he would always be the king. He may not have a king, doesn't have a castle, but the king will always be, because he's been anointed by God and the people have accepted that. So this is a kind of a really odd paradigm. You just don't throw out the king. Now, you can kill the king, but you still had to wait for somebody in the line of succession to come along and actually become the next monarch, because you just couldn't, select, your Napoleon Bonaparte back in those days. It had to be somebody from the line, which is one of the reasons why the land barons, when they drew swords on King John, they felt it fit to give him the opportunity, because they at least saw that he was, amenable to, hearing what they wanted and actually meeting their demands, which is what they ended up getting. So does that make sense, Sean? What we're looking at is the teeth in this petition, that ultimately the king is offering up his kingdom other than his throne.
Yes, sir.
And so that's a lot. That's a huge promise. Now, I won't get into how it translated down, but as we kind of finish the rest of this, it will kind of help everybody, see, I guess, in the grand scheme of things, the king really meant that, I'll just say he really meant some mechanism. He was really trying to provide a true mechanism of giving the people of Britain a feeling of security that they would honor these promises, these rights, and so forth. So let's go ahead and finish this up.
Whoever in the country, and let whoever in the country desires it, swear to obey the orders of the said 5 and 20 barons for the execution of all the aforesaid matters, and along with them to molest us to the utmost of his power. And we publicly and freely grant leave to everyone who wishes to swear, and we shall never forbid anyone to swear. All those, moreover, in the land who of themselves and of their own accord are unwilling to swear to the 25, to help them in constraining, molesting, us, we shall by our command compel the same to swear to the effect foresaid. And if any one of the 25 barons shall have died or departed from the land, or be incapacitated in any other manner which would prevent the foresaid provisions being carried out, those of the said 25 barons who are left shall choose another in his place according to their own judgment, and he shall be sworn in the same way as the others. Further, in all matters, the execution of which is entrusted to these 25 barons, if perchance these 25 are present and disagree about anything, or if some of them after being summoned are unwilling or unable to be present, that which the majority of those present ordain or command shall be held as fixed and established, exactly as if the whole 25 had concurred in this. And the said 25 shall swear that they will faithfully observe all that is aforesaid, and cause it to be observed with all their might. And we shall procure nothing from anyone, directly or indirectly, whereby any part of these concessions and liberties might be revoked or diminished. And if any such thing has been procured, let it be void and null, and we shall never use it personally or by another.
Okay, so that kind of wraps up this promise given to the people of using this right of petition. Now, history goes, and we have the siege of Britain under the puritanistic paradigm of Cromwell. And so he kind of rules with an iron fist. The Danish monarchs decide to support a rebellion of England so that they could get back to doing their pagan Christmas or winter wilding. We kind of covered that. And so the Glorious Revolution, because the Glorious Revolution wasn't just about paganism, it was about religious freedom. The reason religious freedom was so important is really the way religion migrated by tyranny of King Henry. When King Henry decided he wanted to have a divorce, he decreed that he was changing the religion of the land, and that upset a lot of people. What he did was he created a powder keg that would literally and ultimately down the road create this huge vacuum that would basically suck people out of England that desired more truth than this political church that was being created so that the king could have his divorce. And those people, many of those people, ended up migrating to America. And they, at that point in time, they became factions. As a matter of fact, when people started realizing that the opportunity to kind of reform the Anglican Church into something different, to something what they perceived was more correct, the Baptist Church and so forth, as all of these different religions were, you know, slowly evolving out of this, I'll just say, this mandate, or the former Roman Catholic Church that became the Anglican Church, all of this became this huge set of factions in England that ultimately created factions of states, where states literally had their different religions, and it became America's problem instead of England's problem. You see what I'm saying? Because at that point in time, Sean, the king got rid of those factions. Yeah. There you go. So if you wanted to have your religious freedom, you had to go over there. Well, at that same point in time, there was this huge uprising that really did occur. And so it was about religious freedom. And what ended up, most people continued to migrate, because this again was in the 1680s. And so when we look at the Glorious Bill of Rights, and we basically dive into this document, we'll find out that, yeah, the Glorious Bill of Rights were claimed and or signed and basically were ingrained onto, you know, the permanency of protecting the people in 1689. So this was practically a century, literally a century before the Constitution, where the Constitution was actually created, where a Bill of Rights was not necessary. So when we come back from the break, we'll dive into this Glorious Bill of Rights. There's only a few things, but we'll be right back diving into it. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
And as I said a few times, we'd be right back. See, we're right back. Now, the English Bill of Rights was just a reaffirmation in many ways. However, one of the things that they realized was when the king started the monarchs started suppressing people from getting together. In other words, this thing called assembly. If you go through the Magna Carta, there was no right of assembly. And so this right here was the beginning of a recognized right that the people could assemble and inform themselves and instruct each other on the common good. In other words, when you look at, and we're going to get into this with the Tory Acts, what these assemblies or the importance of assembling is, but we just want to go through the Bill of Rights at this point, and then we're going to show you how this gets applied into the Tory Acts and actually into the awakening of America. The king made a huge mistake, and we'll get into that before we get into all of that. But let's actually get through the Bill of Rights, because what is important here is this concept of the assembly, and that the right of petition and assembly kind of go hand in hand. So there are a few paragraphs that I'm going to read through that when they go through one, you know, this, two, this, three, right up on the top of the list here, by committing and prosecuting divers worthy prelates for humbly petitioning to be excused from concurring to the said assumed power. In other words, this is one of the things that, one of the causes of what they needed to do. So down the chain here, they actually start identifying, you know, what these things are or what they to be. And thereupon, the said lords spiritual and temporal and commons, pursuant to their respective letters and elections, being now assembled in a full and free representative of this nation, taking into their most serious consideration the best means for attaining the ends aforesaid, do in the first place, as their ancestors in like case have usually done, for the vindicating and asserting their rights, their ancient rights and liberties declared. This assembling is literally creating a provincial government, a local government, and that's what they were talking about, in creating this free representative government. Even though Parliament was created by the Magna Carta, in other words, the people kind of had a representation, but the king was still able to rule them. And even though they had these representatives, those representatives really didn't represent the people. They were pretty much controlled, and we kind of covered this last year when we went through the ratification debates, how the people really weren't covered, why this right of assembly and the need for them to basically identify representatives in an assembly to represent them was important. So as we go down to this last part, That is the right of the subjects to petition the king, and all commitments and prosecutions for such petitioning are illegal. Now, for the most part, that kind of wraps up the assembling and petitioning. But the whole point that it identified was when you had to redress, people had to talk. And one of the tactics that the monarch was doing prior to the Glorious Revolution was when all of a sudden they would create laws that you couldn't assemble unless you were a church or in the marketplace. You couldn't assemble and have conversations, you know, in groups of greater than a certain number or what have you, so that they made sure that people weren't actually, you know, organizing themselves. The right of assembly and choosing representatives as such actually allowed them not to just be able to assemble to organize, but to choose and elect people to represent them into an assembly, into a provincial government. Therefore, when we kind of look at the Tory Acts as we get ready to dive into those, that actually is going to identify these provincial governments. Now, in 1763, the king decided that he needed to pay down this debt he was carrying in prosecuting the Indian Wars in the Americas, as well as some of the other things that he just had this debt. And so it was his intent to lay taxes upon the Americans that became a little onerous. Instead, because prior to this whole tyranny of taxation, the king, using his mercantile management, was basically using the production of the colonies, what they produced, as a mechanism of making his revenues, because he would take the tobacco, he would take these products and sell them abroad. That's really where he got his gold and silver. There was hardly any gold and silver in America. We also learned this in the ratification debates, and this is why prior to the Constitution, most exchanges, most currency was literally cash crops. There were scripts that they started creating during the revolutionary time, as they literally broke away, and they said, we have to have our own currency, because having those scripts and having that type of currency, or having the species of coins, gold and silver coins, was hard to come by. What ended up happening was maybe you sold something and you know they paid you in gold and silver. You had to buy something. They wanted that gold and silver back. So the chance of you holding on to that was pretty difficult, especially when they were requiring those types of payments. So what the Americans had to do was that they had to create a commodity exchange system where they created a value for different crops of so much, so that you could literally create an exchange. This much beans and corn and blah, blah, blah was worth this much in these goods or what have you. So they literally started creating this cash crop. And the number one cash crop was tobacco, because tobacco was of high, one of the most highestly desired by the king. In other words, the king was paying the best or the most from the growers. But most people didn't want to grow tobacco because it decimated the ground. It literally took the nutrients, and the ground was dead. It took like 7 years for the soil to recuperate to be able to grow crops again. So anyway, back to this the disassembling of the governments of the colonies in 1763. It didn't happen immediately. People had to literally start realizing what was going on, because they didn't see it on the television news. They didn't hear about it because they didn't necessarily have a great newspaper system or a media system. It was very limited, and so it took time. And usually the places close to the government, the seat of government, like the capital of the colony, those places kind of knew, but it took a long time to get out there. So between 1763 and 1773, it took a while before there was enough provincial governments to actually start getting organized, where people literally started communicating and petitioning the king. In other words, they were assembling, and the things that these assemblies did was they petitioned. They didn't go and steal tea and dump it into the drink, like the Sons of Liberty. They considered that, civil unrest. They call that criminal. I mean, the framers and our forefathers, they were law-abiding citizens. They shuddered at the idea of breaking the law. They would rather actually petition and demand their rights because they had rights to these things. So the king, getting back to the king made this decision to literally do this one thing, that he was going to tax them, and that was it. Now, the people of America said, hey, no taxation without representation. We should have a right to be represented in Parliament. Ergo, you need to open up seats in Parliament so that we can come and be represented. And the king made a business decision to not let that happen. He would rather, and he believed, he would get away with actually moving forward into this war. Actually, he didn't even know there was a war coming. He felt moving forward, he was just going to maintain and started doing there was the abominable taxes and the coercion taxes or what have you. I forget all the different names that they came up with. Two were really outstanding of the different groups of taxes that the king levied upon them. But nevertheless, they actually decided to start petitioning and organizing to a greater level because the king was ignoring them. He was ignoring the beloved children in America. So by this point in time, when he received, actually, just let me jump forward. When he received the Declaration of Independence, he had a business decision to make. Do I really think that I would be better off granting them, access to Parliament and representation and go ahead and tax them? Or should I spend some money on actually, going to war with them and teaching them a very valuable lesson by oppressing them under my heel of justice? And the king decided to do the latter instead of the former. And so by going into war or basically extending, his response with violence, because the shot that was heard around the world, in other words, the little skirmish in Concord, Massachusetts, literally launched them into a war. Now, at any point in time, the king could have probably said, this is going to cost us a lot of money, and I just don't see us, gaining anything. But he really never thought that he would end up losing. And so even at the very end when they decided to go for independence, I have no idea whether he was saying, look, please come back and we'll give you representation. We will heal the kingdom and the Americas will be a part of, the governing class of Parliament. I mean, so Sean, if you look at this as far as the business goes, was this not, if there was a historical bad business decision of all time, I believe King George should actually have that. I mean, there's people that have made brilliant decisions, business cases that have launched them into, these huge, global corporations. But I believe that King George made the worst business decision of all history.
I agree. And think about what we might not have had the Civil War if that were the case.
That's right.
Because
that's right.
The way that went, that topic went in England.
That's right. And so, had we not had that war, then we wouldn't have had a Civil War, and slavery and everything else would have actually just been perpetuated, because the spirit of independence and this concept of all men are born free, and this whole Declaration of Independence, the axioms that are in that, I'm just going, wow. I mean, Wow. He really mucked up. Go ahead.
Do you think that their actions against the industry of slavery were meant to hinder the United States at the time?
So if you read the Declaration of Independence, it identifies why and how the king deliberately used this separation, or I should say specifying blacks. This was back in the 1600s when they specified that all slaves would be black in America. In other words, everybody else would be indentured servants. They could go there. They could for 7 years work and receive land and then become a freeman or what have you, as they, you know, because you got the land. And once you started actually paying your poll tax, once you could make money to pay, you know, to vote and those types of things, you became a freeholder. But those people, you know, their children, actually, they had to make money enough to be able to buy land for their children so that they would become freeholders. If not, they weren't freeholders. Anyway, long story short, though, is that when we look at America and this, what the infliction of slavery, the Declaration of Independence identified this concept that the blacks, only the blacks would be the slaves, and then down the road they actually used this hatred or this, the byproduct of this black-white society, created these biases and prejudices and hatred. And so the king, prior to the Declaration of Independence, and you know, I think it was during these periods of unrest in America, trying to get their, you know, representation from the taxation, the king actually staged a coup in one of the states or one of the colonies where he got weapons and so forth and organized a resistance of slaves that literally killed people and damaged stuff and so forth. And, you know, yay to, you know, for the cause of liberty. But, you know, that wasn't viewed very well because the king was basically already meddling in these affairs when he shouldn't have been. This was one of those, that's why it was a grievance in the Declaration of Independence that he was doing this crap. And the fact that the slavery and the way they managed slavery dictated slavery. And so the fact that that's not taught in the school system, to me, is criminal. Because most people think it was just the people here in America that made slavery the way it was, and that wasn't the case at all. It was a manipulation by the crown. But anyway, so these provincial governments, how do we know about them? Because actually, when we go into the next document after the Tory Acts, the next document will be the Articles of Association, because when we get the Tory Acts is after Continental Congress forms. Prior to Continental Congress forming was, you know, they sent the delegates and they formed the Articles of Association and they formed the first petition. Those occurred in 1774. In October 1774, before the Tory Acts. The very first Tory Act was a year later. So, as we kind of look at the way things kind of, you know, unfurled, we can kind of see, because the first Tory Act of 1775 was kind of a response a year later in trying to, okay, hey, look, we need to get a good handle on this. When did the king send over this response to the English organizing and so forth and creating Continental Congress? It was in 1775 already, because 1775 was the launching of aggression in Massachusetts. It took a year to get to the Declaration of Independence. So, folks, if you look at the timeline, 1774, they organized Continental Congress and they petitioned the king. This was in late October. By the time the king got it, it's probably December time frame. And the king said, are you kidding me? Who do they think they are? So he had time. He amassed some troops and got some ships together. And as soon as good sailing weather occurred, he put them on a ship and sent them over. And his formal response was, take that, Massachusetts. So if you follow all of this, now in the spring of 1775, all of a sudden, these colonies, instead of getting some kind of response of, you know, well, let's talk about this, instead it was the iron fist. And so they were basically caught on their heels. They had no power in the Articles of Association to really do anything. All they were really doing was trying to coordinate, pleading to the other colonies, please send militia to Massachusetts. Please help Massachusetts. Everybody rallied to Massachusetts because that's where the king focused his aggression. So anyway, as we kind of look at the timeline, everything kind of lines up. So in 1775, October of 1775, 6 months after these aggressions had started, the very first Tory Act was released. So Sean, go ahead and read the Continental Congress, October 6th, 1775 Tory Act. It's very short. Go ahead.
Whereas, the first one, October 6th, resolved that it be recommended to the several provincial assemblies or conventions and councils or committees of safety to arrest and secure every person in their respective colonies whose going at large may, in their opinion, endanger the safety of the colony or the liberties of America.
Okay, so right there, the several provincial assemblies, conventions, councils, so they're identifying that the colonies kind of came up with their own naming, right? And so they had their own name for their provincial governments, but they do clearly identify them as the provincial governments. Okay, so the next Tory Act, now, here they're basically telling, go arrest all of these people. Now, at this point in time, they really don't feel like that's the safest thing to do because the provincial governments are just like shadow governments, and that each colony, the king has got his own, governors in there and is kind of ruling. So they already kind of have a presence. And they're very apprehensive of saying, hey, we're here to fight you, and now we're arresting these people. And this would have actually played out that we were organized and we were going to start doing these things. And I think that it would have backfired. So these provincial governments said, we can't do this. You're basically asking us to, this is a suicide run. Seriously? You want us to do this? So in January, they send back the next Tory Act is in response to the negative feedback that the Continental Congress got from all of these provincial governments of the states or the colonies. Go ahead.
Whereas it has been represented to this Congress that diverse, honest, and well-meaning but uninformed people in these colonies have by the art and address of ministerial agents been deceived and drawn into erroneous opinions respecting the American cause and the probable issue of the present contest, resolved that it be recommended to the different committees and other friends to American liberty in the said colonies to treat all such persons with kindness and attention, to consider them as the inhabitants of a country determined to be free, and to view their errors as proceeding rather from want of information than want of virtue or public spirit, to explain to them the origin, nature, and extent of the present controversy, to acquaint them with the fate of numerous petitions presented to His Majesty, as well by assemblies as by Congresses, for reconciliation and redress of grievances, and that the last from this Congress, humbly requesting a single favor of being heard, like all the others, has proved unsuccessful, to unfold to them the various arts of administration to ensnare and enslave us, and the manner in which we have been cruelly driven to defend by arms those very rights, liberties, and estates which we and our forefathers had so long enjoyed unmolested in the reigns of His Present Majesty's predecessors. And it is hereby recommended to all conventions and assemblies in these colonies liberally to distribute among the people the proceedings of this and the former Congress, the late speeches of the great patriots in both houses of Parliament relative to American grievances, and such other pamphlets and papers as tend to elucidate the merits of the American cause. The Congress being fully persuaded that the more our right to the enjoyment of our ancient liberties and privileges is examined, the more just and necessary our present opposition to ministerial tyranny will appear.
All right. So at that point, they really took a different tune. At this point in time, you can tell that they realized that maybe it would be better to start persuading these British loyalists to say, hey, you know, look at what they're doing, and why aren't you on the cause of liberty? I mean, we're just looking to, you know, obtain our rights. That's, and they're ignoring us. I mean, what about our right of petition and redress? We're not getting that. Is this acceptable for ourselves? And so this really, I think, helped, I think, change some of the hearts. But if you really look at the numbers, the amount of people that supported the revolution was pretty low that I directly supported it. Many people ideologically supported it, but there were some that were pretty vocal in not supporting it. They were called the Tories. Now, this again is January 2nd. In other words, a year and 2-3 months after the first petition went from Continental Congress over. Things didn't happen quickly back in those days. Time to travel, you know, time to communicate, time to organize. It took time back in those days. So as we kind of look at, you know, where they are and how they, you know, a few months later change their tune and come back and say, well, let's use a PR campaign and try to persuade our brethren of these colonies to work with us. So let's keep going ahead and notice how they keep on asserting or laying it out, the assemblies, conventions, and committees. In other words, they're talking back to these provisional governments to basically say, you know, we recognize what you're doing. We need you to do this. So in other words, it's like they're speaking to the agents that they're representing, because technically that's exactly what Continental Congress was. The representatives of these provincial governments are actually of these states. Because what happened, the provincial governments ended up creating these committees of correspondence at the state level. And the committees of correspondence were the ones that I think appointed those delegates that would go to Continental Congress. Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Benjamin Franklin were three of the key players. I think John Hancock was there as well. So when we look at, you know, who the key players, who those key voices were, we're talking about the who's who of the time. So let's go ahead, and we've got actually less than, you know, a minute here. So at this point, we'll come back and finish this in our next episode, this part of the Tory Act. There are a few other Tory Acts. And why we go through this is so critical, because you can actually see the timeline of how they're responding and the ultimate response, you know, of the Declaration of Independence, because the communication started actually increasing and getting a little bit more succinct. But anyway, anything, Sean? Anything to add?
No, sir. Okay. It's very insightful to see how their tenor changed.
Yeah.
When they realized,
yep.
I mean, what do you think? You think it was like trepidation about going up against the greatest empire in the world?
So we're losing you over the volume of the outgoing music. So what we'll do is, when we come back, because I think you're bringing up a great point, because it actually does, it slaps you in the face. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.